Mundas podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Mundas podcast. I'm here with Phil Cannon from the Who's He podcast. Would you like to tell people how they can find out about you, Twitter, etc., please?
Yeah, sure. Well, you can find us on Twitter on the user ID Who's_He_podcast. You can find us on iTunes if you just search for Who's He podcast. And you can also have a quick look at our website as well if you want, which is who's-he.co.uk.
Nice. So today you want to talk about Sir John Pertwee, of course. And so what's the reason behind that? What's the pull for you in terms of John Pertwee's Doctor?
Well, he was the first Doctor I can remember watching. I must have been, God, blimey, probably about 3 years old. About 3 or 4 years old, and I can remember watching The Green Death, you know, the one with the giant maggots and all that, and that's what sort of, what I can remember from that is Pertwee, giant maggots, and a miner screaming. That's all I can remember. But for some reason, I was hooked on Pertwee after that, and I just wanted to know more about him. But of course, I suppose you could say, really, I should be more into Tom Baker, because that's who I really grew up watching. But I always want to know more about Pertwee all the time. And then I think I picked up one of the very early editions of Doctor Who magazine, which I think had Tom Baker on the front posing with a Dalek, naturally. But he went in to describe a bit more about the previous Doctors. And when it got to Pertwee, it said, James Bond-style action. And I thought, I'll have some of that.
It's right. Funny because on the BBC page about John Pertwee, it has keywords and it says dandy yellow car, purple velvet unit, Wurzel Gummidge, Venusian karate, and then eye patches and the Whomobile. So they're sort of things that people kind of obviously thought, yeah, that's what I associate. But yeah, he was a kind of like a James Bond type figure, wasn't he? More than the other Doctors, I think.
Yeah, he was, I mean, compared to... so like Hartnell and Troughton, he was a man of action, which I think Pertwee had a lot to do with. He was always known as a comedic actor. And actually, what a funny thing I found that he was still doing the Navy Lark on radio while he was doing Doctor Who.
All right.
And that ran from, and I didn't believe this, it ran from 1955, I believe, to 1977.
Jeez.
So I think it's one of like the UK's longest running radio shows. But I never realised. I just thought it was just a show done in the 50s and 60s. And that was it. But no, he was still doing it right until 1977. So, which I found absolutely amazing, to be honest.
Well, Planet of Spiders, the finale, is obviously a big example of this because it was almost like a bucket list, if you like, in a modern term, but a bucket list of what he wanted to do in Doctor Who all in six episodes, wasn't it?
It was. It was one big chase scene, wasn't it? I mean, one episode was just one big chase scene. A gyrocopters, the Whomobile, Bessie, Jeeps, speedboats, there was everything. So, yeah, I mean, it was like James Bond, really, to a funny degree. But, yeah, but that's what I liked about him. You know, he was a man of action, but he was also, he was a little bit sort of anti-authority as well to a certain degree.
Yeah, it was strange because it was a unit family and he was almost like he was in with the establishment, but he was still a bit of a maverick. It was a weird sort of, yeah, he was kind of working from the inside, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, he always had time, say, for like the Brigadier and Benton and Captain Yates and all that. But every time there was a story that featured a government minister, immediately he was at loggerheads with them, which I loved. The things like... A Clause of Axos, with the Mr. Chin character. It was your typical buffoonish government minister who's out to looking after, you know, everything he does, it's to for his own ends, it's for his own purposes, and to further his career. And they always gave Pertwee those sort of characters to sort of butt heads with. And I love that. I love that because you always get like Pertwee can, only Pertwee can say words like nincompoop and what was it, one other particular one, a quizzling was another one. You just don't hear those sort of words anymore. But just the way he delivered them and sort of like just pricking the balloon of their sort of their pomposity. Even though the Doctor himself could be quite pompous. Or especially
I was talking to someone recently, I've seen he's quite arrogant if you think about it. You know, he's very, very self-assured.
Oh, God.
You know, he's... I mean, obviously, Tom Bacon and other doctors, well, not necessarily Davison, but are very commanding, you know, and I'm right, you're wrong, that sort of thing. And I think Pertwee was very much like that, even though he was dressed in a cape, you know.
It takes a certain man to carry that look off, so it really does. But I think that was the whole thing. Compared to what came before him, Troughton and Hartnell, it was like a... I don't know what it must have been like to people at the time, whether it was like a breath of fresh air, because it was also in colour as well. And you've got this guy, because you had, Hartnell was like an Edwardian gentleman. You had Trout, which I think they labelled a cosmic hobo.
Hmm.
And then you had, say, Pertwee, as you said earlier on, a dandy. And there he was, yeah. In the crushed velvet smoking jacket, frilly shirt, and a cape. I mean... It must have been a right culture shot, but as I say, he carried it off well.
And hit the ground running with the first colour episode, which was Spearhead from Space as well. And I would say that's probably one of the best Pertwees. I mean, there are a lot of good Pertwees, but I think they really hit the ground running with that one. You know, you knew who the Doctor was. And he didn't, obviously, but...
for a while, yeah.
but the Nestines were perfect, you know, the Nestine Auton thing. You know, they become a great thing, and obviously they tried to resurrect that in Rose, didn't they, when they brought Doctor Who back?
Mm.
Not as well done in Rose, but nonetheless it's still a good monster. Obviously.
Mondes.
But in terms of, you were mentioned just off air there, in terms of Dalek episode, you said you wanted to talk about Day of the Daleks. My first poetry was Death to the Daleks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I remember getting the VHS when I was about, I don't know, 6 or 7 from Boots, because Boots still sold videos then.
Yeah.
And I got that one. It's not a classic, Death of the Daleks, but it has some nice model of the kind of the city thing. That's quite cool. But Day of the Daleks, I remember getting that on video, and the Daleks aren't massively prominent, other than not the main thing here.
No, they're not. I don't think it's until at the end of the second episode they appear as the what do you want to call it, the closing scene before it goes to the end credits. So I suppose you could say they were used quite sort of sparingly for a Dalek story of its time. But but it'd been the first time the Daleks have appeared for a number of years. And then they returned in colour, and you had the god Dalek and everything. Yeah. But It's got a bit of a checkered history, this one, because they'd obviously forgotten how to do the Dalek voices as well.
Yes, yeah. I haven't seen the new version yet. Have you seen the new version with the new voices?
Oh, I'm telling you, the new version is a thing of beauty. It is a thing of beauty. It really is. They've done such a great job with it.
Mm.
And it doesn't detract from the original story either. You know, they haven't ruined it with too many up-to-date special effects. The way they've done it is if they had that sort of technology in the 70s, if you see what I mean.
Yeah,
it still looks like 70s special effects, but it just looks a lot crisper and cleaner.
When you're getting the DVDs now, do you put the effects on, or do you generally just like the original ones?
I tend to watch if they do like a one with new effects, I'll watch that first.
Yeah.
Just out of curiosity more than anything else. But I'd heard so many great things about Day of the Daleks special edition, and I just went straight for it. And I must admit, I haven't actually watched the original edition.
Right. Because I remember watching the original edition, so obviously I can't compare it. But when I've seen other sort of ones, I've recently watched, for me, since I watched Death of the Daleks the other night, and... the effects of that are quite nice, you know, and I think Enlightenment's quite a good effects package that they've done on that. Have you seen Enlightenment with effects on?
I haven't, no. No, I've yet to buy that one, actually. I'm
it's
still
nice, it works nice. It's the ship looks, they've got some nice kind of effects, like, so the kind of, when it pans to the ship, the actual sailing ship and all that, it actually looks a bit more classy, not like a really bad prop. You know, so it's
I think
sometimes obviously it's not everyone's gonna like having the effects on, but when it affects people want to laugh at it because the bad Dalek voices, I think you've got to do something, you know. So
yeah, that's it. Well, there's another thing in Day of the Daleks as well, which caused a bit of controversy at the time, is the Doctor shooting an Ogron.
Right.
And the reason it's controversial is because the Ogron wasn't actually doing anything; it was just walking towards him. And the Doctor's had this sort of laser, one of the Ogron's laser guns with him, and then just raised arm and shot the guy dead at point blank range. So what they've done, because it's so unlike the Doctor to do something like that. So what they did, they re-shot some footage with some new Ogron costumes, and got the actor to raise his gun first. So look, it makes it like the Doctor is defending himself.
Right.
It looks okay. It's not like Greedo shot first in the Star Wars editions, which is still angers people to this day. So, but this actually fixes something that you could probably say was wrong to begin with.
Yeah.
But I just loved the story, the whole thing. You know, the you got the freedom fighters from the future going back into the past to avert this massive war. And as it turns out, it was them that caused it.
Nice. You know, it's nice how it works out.
Yeah, that's it. It's a fantastic story. And the fact it starts off like a ghost story as well.
Hmm.
It's almost like a haunted house, because you've got this guy, Reginald Stiles, or Sir Reginald Stiles, I should say. Yet again, another one of the long line of Pertwee's government officials to argue with. But essentially, he was a good man, though. That was the thing. He was, you know, which made a nice change, to be honest. But, so it starts with him thinks he's seen a ghost, and it's actually one of these guerrilla fighters from the future have come back to assassinate him. So UNIT are called in to provide security, you know, sort of like the Europe's bouncers, I suppose you could call UNIT back in those days. And then and then it sort of spirals out, you know, off from there. And Joe gets taken back into time. The Doctor goes back with the gorillas as well. And then they meet sort of humanity then. And you've got, like, basically people have just sort of rolled over and died to get in with the Daleks. And they're sort of subservient to them. And you've got, like, the sort of gorilla movement. And it's just absolutely brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. But there's a bit in it that still makes me laugh now. And I don't know if you've seen it recently. It's the chase on the little tricycle, the motor trike thing, what you want to call it.
I can't remember it, but if it was early 70s, I imagine it was a bit Benny Hillish, you know.
it was a little bit, because Joe and the Doctor clamber onto this thing, and again, I think it was just there just to appease Pertwee, because there hadn't been any chases up until that point, and we know how Pertwee's Doctor loved the gadget.
Oh, yeah.
And there was no Bessie in this one, so you had to have at least one at least one episode where he gets to drive something, and this was it. And I think they just sort of this is great new thing, this is like a motorcycle trike thing with these great big fat massive wheels on it. I thought, oh, that'd be brilliant, you know. So when him and Joe escape from this compound, this thing just happens to be sitting there with the engine running, despite not ever seeing them before, and they jump on it and drive away. But the trouble is, it's so slow, you could catch up with it walking at a brisk pace. Right, so, but they get the Ogrons off and they lumber around trying to sort of to grab hold of him. It doesn't last very long.
That's good, because if it went on for too long, Mondas
podcast, Mondas podcast.
I was also going to ask you as well, in terms of the era, do you like the music that's used in the Pertwee era?
It's weird, the Pertwee era, because now and again they would be quite experimental with things like the Sea Devils.
Mm-hmm.
The score for that, I mean, I love it. I love the score to that because it's so different and it's really eerie, but it seems to suit the whole nature of the sea that has been underwater and, you know, sort of this other world beneath the waves.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, it just, I think to me it really works. But a lot of people really hate that score.
I can understand that because I make my own music and synthesizer kind of experiment music. And it does actually sound like a synthesizer is having a breakdown. You know, it genuinely does.
It does at times, yeah.
Yeah, but you're right, it does work, that sort of aquatic nature to it, and it does sound a bit bizarre, but I think it works with the Sea Devils. I don't know if it would work, say, with, I don't know, the Demons or something like that, I don't know, or Three Doctors. It definitely wouldn't work with Three Doctors, you know.
No.
But it works in that context. But sometimes music can be a bit intrusive, I think, especially when it's experimental. But I don't think they go too far experimental. I think it's just maybe that one episode where it was a bit weird.
Yeah, I think some of the time, though, some of the music they were doing, it could be a little bit shrill, if you see what I mean, now and again. It was just a little bit too, they sort of, I don't know what it was, it just pitched a little bit too high. Yes. And sometimes it was a little bit jarring. And it didn't seem quite, it didn't suit at all. There's a bit in The Three Doctors, now you mention it, and there's a bit when the Doctor and Joe are driving back in Bessie, back to unit headquarters, and the music accompanying it, it's all like, it's like, as you say, it's like Carry On. I expect Barbara Windsor to come, you know, bodying that in High Hills any moment. You know, it's really weird, but a lot of the time it does kind of work. But then you get to like Pertwee's final season, and you've got sort of what I would say is more the classic Doctor Who incidental music, because you've got a lot more sort of actual instruments being used, yeah, again, rather than just electronic. But you've got sort of, it's like a weird hybrid, and I quite like that as well. But apart from, as you say, in Death to the Daleks, you've got a score by Carey Blyton, which is unlike anything else. I think the other score he did that I seem to remember was Revenge of the Cybermen as well. I think that's a Tom Baker story. I think that's the other one he did. But he did a theme for the Daleks. And a lot of it, I think it was using a lot of woodwind and stuff. But actually, if you listen to Adventures in Time and Space and Music podcast, they just recently did one on Carey Blyton, and he uses the score on that as an example. I can't sort of do it because I'm a little bit sort of tone deaf, but the Daleks music, and it's really peculiar because it's not dramatic at all. You've got these.
Sometimes when you've got a theme sort of thing for enemy coming in, it has to be good or just sounds a little bit comical, doesn't it?
Yeah, and this does sound comical.
Yeah, you don't want to kind of be started going, oh, now I can't take them seriously now because they've got some sort of crappy end music, you know. That's a problem, but you don't realise how important music is, you know. If you do notice it,
yeah,
it's either great or it's rubbish. You know, they're the two variations, aren't they?
There's another. I forgot the other Carey Blyton was the Silurians.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I was watching a documentary about the Silurians the other week, and you're right about the music, because there was bits where the Silurians were coming on the way, and it was a bit like, hey, you know, it's the Silurians, you know.
Yeah.
rather than unsettling.
Well, I actually thought for years, I thought it was a kazoo. But apparently it's not. Apparently, I think it's a flugelhorn is what they use.
It doesn't really work, no.
But I'll tell you what, though, I admire them for doing something different, for being being experimental. You know, sometimes it pays off. For me, it does with, say, like the Sea Devils. Mm. Other times it's a little bit, as you say, a little bit, hey, here come the Silurians, you know.
Mondes.
The final thing, the main thing we wanted to talk about was going to be Inferno, and that's, if anyone who hasn't seen it, it's an epic 7-part with people wearing eye patches and with alternative universes. Sounds crazy. It sounds like something I would make up, but no, it's real. And Inferno is brilliant. what kind of thing that really gets you about Inferno is that the alternative universe, because Doctor Who doesn't do that massively, does it, really?
No, I think this was like the first time it was done, and it also made the well, like the Doctor's trips with the alternate universe. It didn't look to be a very comfortable journey either, did it? It was not like in, say, like when you got to like David Tennant with the Cyberman, the first Cyberman Age of Steel two-parter. They just seemed to have just slipped sideways and that was it, and they lost a bit of power. But when Pertwee does it, it seems to be like quite a perilous journey that it could, you know, potentially be fatal. You know, and I think they didn't mind putting the Doctor through those kind of things back in those days either.
To be, quite scary, wasn't it?
It
just felt a bit like, oh, well, it's just another thing. When David Tennant handled it, it was like, oh, well, never mind, you know.
Yeah, but this looked like it could be quite fatal, you know, if you weren't the Doctor, basically. But, yeah, I mean, I've actually spoken about this on another podcast, but... And I picked that as my favourite Doctor Who story, and it still is. And I will talk about it till the cows come home. Because, okay, it is a little bit padded, as a lot of Pertwee's stories were, to be honest. In 7 episodes, it's long. But for me, it doesn't drag. I still love it. I think everyone gives fantastic performances in it. I think Caroline John and Nicholas Courtney in particular are absolutely brilliant. And especially Courtney as the brigade leader with his eye patch and don't forget the scar as well.
Of course. I think they relish these roles, you see. I think it's played a bit different, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you could tell they're really, really getting into it. But I just love that. And the whole thing about the alternate universe, it's like this fascist state. And I think the other thing I thought was really bold, there is no incidental music whatsoever in that story. And all you've got all the way through it is just the humming of the drilling machinery.
All right, I'd never noticed that, but yeah, that's good because that's sort of like weird industrial incidental music kind of works. Yeah,
yeah, it is. Yeah, and it's but the thing is, you don't notice that there's no music. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I just really love that, and I don't know again if it was they just didn't have time to record any music or be able to get any like stock library music or anything, or it was a conscious decision because it just gave it that otherworldly, it had a really strange atmosphere
maybe that was the whole alternative universe trying to make it unsettling, you know.
Yeah, and I think at the end where sort of the alternate universe goes basically blows up, and as the world's getting hotter, I just love the camera filter effects. They give like the atmosphere is heating up,
yeah.
And it looks horrible. It looks like a really horrible. It looks horrible enough anyway in the alternate universe. But when it's sort of the Earth's heating up and you can almost feel like they're breathing in hot air. I think it's so well done for its time.
It is. It's experimental considering it's so early in the run as well. You know,
yeah.
It's about the third or fourth show, isn't it?
Yeah, well, this was the last story of the season, and I think that Pertwee's first season, which would have been in old money, the 7th season of Doctor Who, I think it's the best season ever. It's my favourite, hands
down.
It's a
good season, yeah.
It really is. I mean, so you start off with Spirit from Space, the Silurians. You've also got. Inferno and
Ambassadors of Death. I've got them in front of us, so I'm cheating. So.
I'm trying to recall the top of my head, but and I think you got 4 really, really strong stories there.
They are. Not to bring the tone down, but do you think there's any points in the Pertwee era where it doesn't hit the mark for you?
Just trying to think. Actually, it's probably something like. Probably stories like The Mutants, possibly.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
I know that they were trying to, with a lot of Pertwee stories, they were trying to sort of reflect what was going on at the time, maybe in like politics or some ecological thing. So you've got things like The Green Death was all about ecological disaster. You had The Mutants, which was basically about colonialism and racism.
Yeah.
Basically. I'm trying to think another one that highlighted. And then, of course, the other one was one of the... I always get confused. It was... I can't even remember the Curse of Peladon, the Monster of Peladon, which...
Well, I was going to say to you that I actually got the box set of the Monster of Peladon and the Curse of Peladon, and I found both of them pretty dreary.
Well, actually, I don't mind the first one, because they brought back the Ice Warriors for that.
Yeah.
And they turned out to be the good guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Which turned that on its head, and I brilliant. I think that's a really, really good thing to do. But come the... Actually, that story had that weird head in a dome, didn't it?
It did, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, that freaked me out when I first saw that.
Well, I actually had a Doctor Who book from when I was younger, and I'd never seen the episode. And I'd always seen the picture of it, and I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. It's more interesting than the actual episode itself.
Yeah.
But I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, we've only mentioned, say, two or three there, you know.
Yeah.
But the rest of them, I mean, if you've got some heavy hitters, like you've got Terror of the Autons, you've got the Demons, you've got Green Death, Sea Devils, you know, to name but a few, you know. So I think some people just can't quite get away with Pertwee himself. I think that's it. Sometimes people just love Tom Baker too much, and, you know, they can't quite get away with this crazy jumping about cape wearing bomb type guy, you know.
I don't know why though, because I must admit, I can remember when we regenerated into Tom Baker, and all I could think of, that was what, 1974 that was, and all I could think of at the time, because I can remember stupid bit, never remember anything useful, I just remember bits of crap out of my childhood. And I remember him regenerating into Baker, and all I could think of, why has John Pertwee now got brown hair? Because it looked almost identical. Like,
yeah,
on the floor.
Yeah.
My little four-year-old brain couldn't handle that at all. I just really couldn't handle that. And even when, I think when Joe Grant left as well, I remember my cousin had a Doctor Who annual for Christmas.
Yeah.
And when they sort of like, I always remember my aunt saying, oh, what do you get for Christmas, Jamie? And he said, oh, Doctor, and it was the last Pertwee Doctor Who annual that came out that year, which must have been 74 then. And I said, I remember saying, oh, is Joe in it? I said, oh, no, it's Sarah Jane. I remember being really disappointed. And I just thought, I don't want to see that.
You see, my first companion was Ace, and then the show ended very like 2 years later, so I didn't really have a follow-up companion. So then it was obviously Rose years later, or if you want to count Grace, I suppose, in the TV movie.
Yeah.
But not many people do, but I don't
know. No, that's true. No.
Mondes.
Follow me on Twitter at IanTodd82, and obviously hashtag Mondes Podcast.
Mondes podcast.